just get started. So my name is Fabian Hartwig-Meissner from Aachen, Germany. And I quite changed the topic right now away from 2D into one-dimensional systems and also into the field of cold atoms and molecular physics. So what I'm going to be talking about specifically is some project we discussed actually almost 3 years ago when Marcus Rigol came to visit at Oak Ridge. The original idea was to have him come in for an interview for a Wigner Fellowship, but since he's from Cuba, he couldn't even enter the lab. So we just gave a talk at UT and then we started to interact. So the benefit that we got out of the visit was these papers that I'm going to be talking about here. So the topic is exactly, we call it the sudden expansion of interacting fermions. In 1D optical lattices. And the people that are involved in this effort are like Salvatore Manmana from Lausanne, and Ariane Fegin, who's here, Hanno Muramax from Stuttgart, and Eva Dagotta from Oakridge. So let me just start with giving a brief introduction about why we bother about looking at time dependence in optical lattices at all. So there's maybe like three topics or three subtopics that we can come up with that are kind of interest. And to be specific, I'll only be looking at the 1D Hubbard model, which is actually what we studied here. So nothing special here, just kinetic energy and talking fermions. Plus on-site Coulomb. So one of the things that people are really excited about right now is this field of quantum benches. And this is something that people can readily realize in optical lattices. So just imagine you have atoms trapped in an optical lattice. Then the parameter that actually controls U and the Hopping T here is essentially the lattice depth here. And essentially this goes as U over 2. An exponential of some constant times square root of that V0 here. So then when you tune V0, you can actually obviously change that ratio here and imagine that you instantaneously drive the system into a very deeper lattice. And then the questions that people have been looking at, and there's like tons of papers on that, including interesting stuff, is for instance, what happens if you start at a state, it's an eigenstate to a given U, and then you quench into a deeper U, are you going to be seeing any kind of relaxation? And in particular, what is the state that it relaxes to, or is it thermalizing or is it not thermalizing? Then, and you could also ask, and that's also an interesting question, what happens in the course of phase, like some phase transition here, which does not happen in this model, but for instance for the Rosenhower model. So there's lots of interesting things going on. Now the second motivation of looking at time dependence in optical lattices is probably that there is not that big a number of experimental probes that we actually have available to look at these systems. So experimentalists kind of hook up their atoms in an optical lattice and there is no nuclear probes like here in condensed matter. So two very nice ideas of probing the things that you can actually measure. And these are typically like momentum distribution functions that you get out of time of light or density profiles, and from density profiles you can compute something like the radius of your cloud of particles that you have in your optical lattice. Or say you can look at double occupancies, and that's a point of view that we'll be looking at a lot later again. And one idea of probing these things is, for instance, that you go into an instantaneous quench here, but you modulate these things, say, V0 becomes something like, plus some amplitude cosine omega t. And then the hope is that the phases that you may have in your system, like a modulating phase or a Luttinger liquid, would have a distinct response in the time dependence of, say, double occupancies of this radius. Or some other thing is just to shift the harmonic confinement and to look at what the profile is. And the third topic is what I've been talking about, and this is more it's not so much related to the questions of thermalization or probing the systems in equilibrium. Like this is just the idea, here's more or less to probe what the system, what the equilibrium phases are. Here we are more interested in some kind of transient regime where we're not actually reaching any thermalized state or relaxed state. And this is this topic of expansion. So here what we have in mind is, again, we basically confine particles in some harmonic trap. So we typically get a particle profile like this here, and then superimposed we have an optical lattice. And what we want to look at is essentially instantaneously at some time t equals zero, we just put cyclotropic potential to zero. So we remove this confining potential here while we actually while we actually want to keep the optical lattice. And what we're looking at is essentially the expansion of these particles here into that optical lattice. Yeah. So the experimental challenge, what people have to be able to control, is that they need to have a laser that essentially gives them the optical lattice and then an independent way of controlling the harmonic confinement. So for instance, what they could do is just use a blue detuned laser for the lattice and a red detuned laser for the harmonic trap, or use a magnetic trap and then the laser just for the optical lattice. Okay, and the method that we actually use in this work is tidally dependent EMG. And I will not explain in much detail. So essentially the setup for our study here looks like this. We basically start, it's a setup in which we confine particles in a box trap. This is just for easier for us to start with, but then later on we will relax that and also look at the harmonic trap here. And one question that we have asked, what are the distinct features when we start from particles escaping from a region which has some average density that can either be like, the filling could either be like smaller than one or exactly one, so we could start from a Mott insulator, or the density could be between one and two. And it turns out that, so this is actually two separate papers that we wrote, and it turns out that there's interesting aspects to the expansion here when you start from something like a Dettinger state or a Mott insulator. And this is what we call, here if I have time I will also talk about this, this is what we, where we introduced this notion of ground state reference systems. So here essentially the idea is asking how non-equilibrium are these non-equilibrium systems, and if I have time I'll tell you in more detail what we find here. So in this case here is actually a little bit more timely, and that's a paper that we just put on format like 2 weeks ago. And here the idea is that we start with states that have a large mixture of double occupancies here. So we start between one and two, and then essentially once we release the trap, we will have dynamics of those double occupancies and the single particles, and there's some interesting stuff. Okay, so this would be the notion of quantum. Okay, so the method essentially does the following. So ground state energy is essentially a method that gives you for a ground state. So this big bubble is supposed to be the entire Hilbert space, and what DMRG essentially does is that it gives you a very good approximation numerically to the ground state wave function for just keeping a very small amount of states here. Now, without going into technical details, what we can do is we can just follow the time evolution once we perform a quench or once we release that trap here of that state here. The one key thing that we need to know about these kind of expansions is that, well, there's actually mathematical statements about the efficiency of the method at, in 1D for the ground state, which basically relies on the fact that we choose a smart base to represent the wave function, which is typically the eigenbasis of reduced density matrix, that in this basis, the decay of weights of states that we keep decays very fast, and that condition actually gets relaxed once we do time evolution. So when we do time evolution, we will eventually explore larger parts of the Hilbert space, and this is the limitation of that method. But it still allows us to follow time evolution up to intermediate times, but not always until time scales, which would correspond to thermalization. Yeah, so the idea is that we can start with a relatively small number of spaces, and then once we continue in time here, once we progress in time, we will need to keep more states, but can you still follow this limitation? So are there any comments or questions?
So just a figure of merit, but that's intermediate timing. How many times do you think it could be?
Yeah, okay, so this really depends on the specific problem, right? This really essentially, to be more specific here, what we do in DMRG is typically we look at five partitions. So this would be the entire system that we're looking at, and we compute the entire the wave function for the super block, and we do this by partition here and get the reduced density matrix for the subsystem here. And in the ground state, as I was trying to explain, there's typically a relatively, if I look at the eigenvalues of the thing here as a function of index, there's typically a relatively fast decay. And then when you do time evolution, essentially, this would change, so it will be to be disadvantage of the method, but it really depends on how much entanglement you're actually creating. So the global quantum quantum ratio changed from, if you change basically U on every side, that's a pretty bad case. This case here is a little milder, as you will see. Actually, the example that I'll be showing is one that is relatively well under control. So the quantity that we need to look at is essentially, that will be crucial later, is essentially the entanglement entropy, sometimes called this OL, that we compute from these sensitive masses. So if this thing grows fast in time, then we are pretty much restricted in time, in the time scales that we can reach. If it doesn't, then we can go pretty far.
But
this really depends on
the time scales, like tenths of one of the t, as compared to
like, no, not necessarily. It's really like this really depends on the specific problem. Like if you think about transport, we apply a bias, and if the bias is small, then we can go to hundreds of t actually instead of reasonable control. So this really
but
depends
on
this
case.
Yeah.
For this type of system.
So this for this okay to be specific here, I think here we went up to 40 times of t. 40 or 30. And I'll tell you later why this actually works on this. Okay, so the idea now is the following. It's a very simple thing, and the feature that I'm using here has been used by other people recently, like Adam Rosch in their papers on superfluidity in expansions in 3D, as a superfluidity of essentially double occupancies. Here's the following. Imagine this here is the interface that separates the region in which originally we had particles from the empty optical lattice here. Then, as I was saying, we wanted to have a case in which there's a lot of particles here, so we have a large number of double occupancies. So imagine there's two particles sitting right next to the boundary. And then let's ask what happens if U is essentially much larger than the bandwidth. Can this cloud then expand, or in which ways can it actually expand? And since this would require that you release a large energy U, the only way that you can essentially move a particle to the empty site is that you need to find a site a site that is essentially single or empty next to this here, which would then conserve the energy. And this means that effectively, as you kind of eject single particles into the optical lattice, you will be piling up the double occupancies in the initially occupied region. And that's the entire idea of the thing, which we call distillation, in the sense that you are separating double occupancies from the single particles that expand. And that means that you end up with a spatial separation of the interaction energy confined in a very short region, and then kinetic energy that is carried over the fast particles. Yeah, sure, that's true. That's a question of time scale. That's a very good point. I'll come to that later. Obviously, also double occupancies can move, but that's a time scale that's u over t squared, and that's much larger typically when U is larger than the bandwidth, then the scale of T. Yeah? So initially, we ask which kind of processes can propagate particles on a scale of T. Yeah? And later on, there will also be timescales on which double occupancies can actually start to move and expand.
So you have this condition U much bigger than T,
right,
and everything that follows, right?
So let me now sketch a few of the quantities that we have looked at to show that this actually works. So I think this is good for whatever I want, but it's also basically public from the paper. So essentially, if you look at, say, the double occupancy average of a couple of sites here, then so this would be normalized to one. So what this typically does is you start from some finite value here, and then if U is really substantially large, we actually almost reach one here. So what we're doing here is essentially we are building up an approximate Fock state of the double occupant set. So we're starting with something that has a density below between 1 and 2, and what we are ending up with is a small piece of a band insulator plus all the remaining particles in this case. And this time scale here is essentially governed by T. So when U is large enough, larger than the bandwidth, then this is essentially independent of U. Yeah, so U plus 14, 120 will essentially lead to the same decay here. And then as Jan was already saying, if I now look at how this band insulator that I have built up here will eventually decay again, then it's better to scale everything as scale time over U over T squared, essentially. And then if I look at the same quantity again, then we see that it builds up, and eventually, again, independent of U, at, in the large time limit, we will basically end up on the same kind of asymptotic behavior on which now double occupied sites expand into the.
Sorry, was for the picture just to the left of that? What is going on the x-axis?
Oh, sorry, this time. This is just time in units of t. And this is not just rescaling everything in units of U over 2 squared. So what I'm saying is that the short-term dynamics is essentially, we're looking at the processes that are governed by T, by single particle hopping. And then the decay of that band insulator is essentially governed by duplons that move on with an effective hopping of T squared.
System size should also enter somewhere in the time scale. So how large your
System size doesn't matter at all. Yeah, it could be more specific. I think system size doesn't really matter, or more specifically, what matters is the extension of that initial state. Is that what you're trying to get?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much. Yeah. It does. So it does matter in the sense that say you keep the initial fitting fixed, and then you increase the length of that system, then essentially this dependence that will be more stable. Yeah. So all of what I'm saying is that you can collapse the curves for different U here onto the same kind of K that's governed by duplons moving, but there's still a prefactor that depends on how many particles you have. So I mean, if you made a dependence there, then essentially it's just moving one of the struggle of the things after the other. So essentially the number of double occupancies this is a prefactor that happens. Now, so I'm saying the entanglement entropy is an interesting quantity to look at, and I was trying to argue that we're essentially getting a short band insulator here. To make this more quantitative, we actually looked at what the entanglement entropy does for blocks of the length that actually include that band insulator that we have dynamically created here. So let's call this maybe L. The I. If you look at that, as a function of time, then this starts from some finite value here, and then indeed eventually almost drops to zero, consistent with the notion that we now have basically a product state of that band insulator with all the remaining particles, and that should be essentially unattained. And this answers Jan's questions why in this case. Actually, the simulation works because this is an example where, although effectively we have some kind of a quench, the entanglement entropy just goes to zero for certain blocks. in this
understand physically why that happens?
Yeah, sure, because you're building up a balance ladder. So this is essentially just, so this state here is balance, you just have just one state per site. So what the full system is, if you is, when you do a bipartition here, then it's a product state of just W occupied sites with all the rest. So that's just needs to run. Now the idea here, okay, and what the idea in that sense is very similar to what Achim has described in his work for that was mentioned earlier, and also similar to the work that was instrumentally done by Winkler et al., that we find here that there is some kind of metastable state that are generated dynamically and then that pay on relatively large time scales. So what could this be used for? The idea, of course, is that that you separate the direction energy from kinetic energy. You basically want to get rid of all the particles that that carry kinetic energy, and then you at some point ramp up the trap again. What you end up with is a piece of balance layer that is just essentially one Fock state, and that should have a relatively low entropy. So this, the idea is that you could use the scheme for cooling purposes, which in quad atoms is still an important thing to reach the temperatures that you that are low enough to actually see anti-Fermat nets or models. Now, so far, just talked about these kind of box traps here. In experiments, they typically have harmonic traps, and that's a little bit more challenging for the setup to. Yeah.
So, good question. So this effect of Dapper's distillation or Fermat distillation. So this is very reliant on the fact that you have a chain, right? So would you have a similar effect if you have like a two-leg ladder, or would that completely kill this?
No, I think it requires. There's essentially three time scales. One is the time scale for forming this this one balance ladder. The second one is the time scale for gluons to essentially start moving. And the third one is the time scale that in 1D we don't see, because it's simply extremely unlikely that the gluons decay into single particles. So a real conversion of kinetic energy interaction energy into kinetic energy. So that's kind of a smooth process. If you have like intermediate use, then you will also see that the interaction energy is converted to kinetic energy. But in this limit of large U, this is an exponential long time scale of the interaction. And it's really, I think, this is the use. Now, the interesting thing is that experimentally they're actually doing this kind of stuff, and what they claim to be seeing is that I shouldn't say claim. Their current understanding is, and it was very preliminary work that they people from Emanuel Bloch's group presented in Pittsburgh, is that they think that they actually see this decay of double occupancies into single particles. Yeah? But there's been this 3D, but this is 1D, so 1D you would expect this to be more unlikely, and
it's fair to say they just probed this Hoshimo, not this Hoshimo. Right, they're not working this Hoshimo like shops the bandwidth.
Right,
they use just of the up to the order of bandwidth in the experiment, so you don't expect that the
number
of W
is. Okay, I should actually put it the other way around then, that I haven't carefully enough looked into intermediate use and view of the order of bandwidth to really see what we would come up with for the experimental quantities. So the quantity that they essentially looked at in experiments is typically the radius of the cloud for the single particles. So there they would essentially expect that this becomes linear, signaling ballistic transport here, so this is in time. And then the other quantity to look at is the radius of the double occupancies. And here they see some kind of decay typically, which they interpret as a conversion of double occupied sites into single particles. Yeah. And the question is exactly what this prefilter factor does as function of U, and that's something that we haven't fully looked at yet. So we are in the limit of relatively large U, and that limit, if I was to plot that quantity 2, the radius of the double occupancies, I would essentially just see that it goes down and essentially it increases again. Okay. Any further comments on this part?
Yeah. questions? So what is now the state? So let's say you go in this limit of very large U,
right.
So you, that number of occupied sites is conserved, and you start from some initial density, and you, then you claim you can always reach the density 1?
No, I don't claim that anymore.
I think that's, certainly that all depends on, because there's two processes. One is the single particles go away, and the second one is that they create this anisotropic hopping.
Yeah,
for the doubly occupied sites, which presses them together.
No,
so,
but
it's unclear how much you can gain.
No, yeah, essentially this is a question. So kind of the efficiency, it depends on really what the initial filling is. Mm-hmm. So we have some kind. I mean, in the paper we called it like weak quantum distillation. So whenever U is larger than 4T, which is the bandwidth in 1D, then we see that at least on some sites the doubly occupancy increases, but not necessarily. Up to that limit where we get a true Fock state, and then when we increase the initial density close to 2, like 1.8, then we end up with this particular case in which we get a Fock state. For the effect of separating, for the image efficiency, you may not really need to get that bandwidth rating state. You might eventually be happy with just having some separating a certain percentage of our double occupancies from as many fast particles as you can manage to get them. Now, so this obviously depends on the initial filling, the total particle number in the initial state, and then again.
Does it depend for your system size? So of the size of the initial region, this filling efficiency, or is it does go to constant value? And you go to
okay, so I think if you I think the efficiency, right? If you ask and if you define efficiency in terms of what percentage of particles you can essentially eject into the empty lattice, then it just depends on the filling, not on the number. So at filling 1.8, I mean basically what we see is you get a band oscillator of 5 sites, of 10 particles there and 8 particles there. So the filling for that. Okay, so I'm not doing timelines. Yeah, so then let me just briefly explain how things work when you actually use a harmonic trap. So typically, as I said, what we need to have for this thing to work is that U should be much larger than the bandwidth. And then we run into the following problem that then like lots of particles will actually log into a mod insulating phase. So we will typically have profiles like this here on this mod insulator, and this will give us a very small fraction of a W occupied size. So when we do this here, this will not be a very efficient way. So then we just play a simple trick and just start with some initial U that is typically smaller than 14. Then we can come up with initial states in a harmonic trap again. Sorry.
Another question is because I'm not going to want to
where typically profiles can be tuned such that we have essentially no mod insulating region, a large amount of double occupancies. But then we do two things at the same time. So first we essentially set the trap to zero, the trap in potential, and then in the second step here,
I'm not going to hear what he's saying.
Oh, sorry, I'm not talking there.
Could you just have a repeat for that?
So, is Atom supposed to repeat on me?
No, Atom was causing the interference. So.
Okay, so the point is when you have you typically have a trap in optical lattices, right, a harmonic confinement, which is not necessary. They can also do box traps, right? Using I think blue light sheets and stuff like that, or dimple traps, so that's not necessarily a restriction, but generically you will have a harmonic confinement. So if you have a harmonic confinement and if U is, and we need a large U, then typically the profiles will be such that you either lock in, that you typically lock in a lot of particles into the mod insulating shell, which is not what we want because we need to have a large number of double occupancies in the initial state. Now the trick that we play now is that we start with an initial U in the presence of that harmonic confinement that allows us to suppress the modern setting shells actually have a large fraction of W frequencies. So then the typical profile looks like this here in the initial state. And then at time t equals zero, we both release the particles from the trap and also quench to a large U. And then the fact that made us really happy is that now, I mean, there's two things that actually lead to a substantial increase of block entropy. One is that you have particles evaporating, which increases which generates entanglement between regions that initially were just empty, and those parts that initially already had particles. So that's an increase in entanglement. And the second one is the increase induced by the quantum fetch. But it turns out that this quantum distillation process, which is good for us, essentially wins. So when I plot the block entropy again for the length of a block that ends up having a quasi slicker, then first we get a substantial increase, but eventually quantum distillation wins, and we again end up this decrease here. Yeah. So this shows that actually even in the more difficult case of a harmonic trap, the scheme should still work. Okay, so this is all what I wanted to say about quantum distillation, and now I think I started. Are there any questions about that until up to this point? No comments? Okay, do we still have like 10 minutes? Or?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So then I will very quickly describe what we discussed for the case when we actually don't have that many double frequencies at all, in the case when we start from either more insulating initial states or states that are more Lagrangian. Okay, so here essentially, imagine we are starting this with a mod insulator. So it's a really flat profile. It's an index here. Then if you measure correlations in that initial state, say you're looking at the modulus of one particle correlations, as a function of distance in that initial state, then this obviously is case exponentially, so this is nice, you can do that in block, blackboard, this block block. This is time t equals zero. And then once you let particles expand into that empty lattice, what you find is that this thing here, this whole ij, will again look like this here. It's a function of I minus j, but now it's just a log. And also this is log linear. And now it's a log log plot. So what we get is that we start from exponential decay of correlations, and what we generate is coherent, so we get a power line, we get moving cloud of particles. So this is one observation. The other observation is that when you look at the structure factor between spin correlations, so essentially S of k, it's a function of momentum, so Sk is just the, let me put it like this, the Fourier transform of Sj, then in the initial state, would typically plot. We will typically start with something that looks like this here. So it peaks at pi, and then as you start the expansion, eventually you will get a relatively smooth maximum at some incremental k prime. So this is time. Larger than you realize, this is time. Now the question is, if you look at this, then, and if you know what the structure factor for a Luttinger liquid looks like, then for the homogeneous case, you would essentially expect something like this, right? Like a kink-like feature. And for equilibrium, and the density is smaller than one, this key prime here, k prime here, is essentially 2k. And the question is now, can we make a similar statement about the non-equilibrium case here? So can we relate the position of this peak here to the average density that the system has at a given time? Yeah? So obviously the density decreases as the system expands because the system size gets larger and larger, and that means that the density goes down. And this is what we see, so this peak keeps shifting from lower. And we don't have a mathematical proof for this, but what we could show is that when we that there is a one-to-one correspondence between this expanding cloud to properly chosen reference systems. And the way we do this is the following. We just take at each time we take the density profile and we measure this time-dependent energy, which will typically be homogeneous, and then we require that this be equivalent, be equal to the density profile in some reference system in this ground state, and we choose the reference system such that this is essentially H naught plus the Hubbard, Hubbard model plus the sum over epsilon I and I. And now we just set consistently determine these the set of epsilon I such that we get the desired density profile. Is that step on the screen? Okay. So when we do this, what we find is that once we have actually managed to reproduce the same density profile, that this also produces in the reference system the same S of k, T would be equal to S of k in the reference system, and the same for density-density correlations, and also for, let's say, body fluctuations. Yeah? So essentially, there is a one-to-one correspondence at each time between the expanding cloud and these reference systems. Yeah, and this is at this point like more like an observation. You could say this is not so surprising because it sounds like time-dependent DFT, which tells you that once you know the entire history of the density profile, that you, knowing the functional, should be able to tell what observables are. So this is more or less like an approximation, like an approximate way of approximating that unknown functional actually in this following this construction. So this means that indeed we can relate this k prime here to the average density given in particle. Okay, so this is all I wanted to say. Thanks for your attention.
So I said climate, by fixing those NIs in the reference system, once you reproduce, you get a human with all these other qualities.
Yeah. So this is numerical control errors. Of course, there is cases where this breaks down. Those are maybe the more interesting ones. But in the case of double, where we have this quantum distillations, then obviously there is a scale on which the density profile changes, which is T. But then we have like particles that move on a scale governed by T, the hopping, and then particles that move on a scale governed by U, which is square. And that is something that the reference systems are not at all able to capture. So there's of course cases where we can tell that this won't work, right? But at least in the case when essentially there's a soup of particles that move with some kind of well-defined velocity distribution that is, so to speak, fast enough to follow the change of the density profile, then this is supposed to work.
So this smells like you want to set up a hydrodynamic theory. So that you're saying, oh, local I have an equilibrium, but you know, minimal requirement for hydrodynamic theory is to take into account all conservation laws in the system, so all continuity equations. So here it's now special because you have an integrable system, so that's anyhow very difficult to talk about. But when you talk about non-integrable system, you would at least want to talk also about the energy. So within the spirit of hydrodynamic approach, you would at least want to fit both energy and density, because that are the kind of natural conserved quantities which have a continuity equation. Just let me mention a counterexample, certainly, for this observation. is if you have a system which equilibrates,
then
you know that the final temperature will, so you kind of assume that your reference system has zero temperature, and you know it will have finite temperature, the correlation functions are temperature dependent, so there should be, there is a difference.
Sure. I mean, this, as I was saying at the beginning, you were interested in some kind of short-term dynamics and the transient regime, right? I'm not claiming that this would work in thermalization.
I'm just saying this is a counterexample for this observation. Sure. So we know if a system equilibrates, then this property doesn't hold. Because beside the density profile, we have another information, which is temperature.
Right. Totally agreed, and I think we were careful about that in the paper. Mm-hmm. I just didn't say all of that. And thanks for the other 2 points, because now I can go on and tell you a little bit more. So the other point was that about non-integral systems, and we actually checked that, and it works. It still works, right? So even if we add like a V here, like an example.
But it should better work. Hmm? In a certain sense, it should work better because hydrodynamics. So this kind of requires local relaxation and
the other point, we also looked at what the energies to compare in these reference systems as compared to the energy that the moving cloud had. And essentially, what we could argue is that the energies just differ by the center of mass motion. Right? So if you can come up with an estimate of what the kinetic energy of the center of mass motion of the cloud is, then this accounts for almost all the difference in kinetic energy between the reference systems and the moving cloud. So in that sense, energy comes into play in the way you'd expect it.
No questions? If not, let's thank Fabian and Smith again.